Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Mike, thank you very much for that very generous introduction. We might have changed interest rates for 2 years, but I don't feel like I've been sitting on my hands. It's very busy doing nothing, as you say. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to speak again at the Anika Foundation. I'm the father of three teenage children, so I really know firsthand how important the issues that the Anika Foundation is working on. So, Mike, and now I really want to thank you and all the other organisations here for continuing to support the work. It's a fantastic turnout. Today I'd like to talk about a long-run issue and a short-run issue. The long-run issue is Australia's demography, and the short-run issue is current monetary policy in Australia. Now, these might seem to be unrelated topics to you, but at the RBA we're very aware that our decisions are not made in a vacuum, that they're influenced by structural developments in our economy, and one of those important structural developments is changes in our demography. At the RBA, we forecast a lot of variables, but we don't forecast population on a daily basis. But I read today that today is the day where our population turns to $25 million. So it's 25 million people. So it's I can't get numbers out of my brain. So 25 million people. So it's an appropriate day that I talk about trends in Australia's demography. Indeed, Australia's demographic profile is more positive than those of most other countries. And it's one of the core reasons that provides a basis for optimism about the future of our economy. Many countries are rightly concerned about population dynamics, their ageing workforces, and the rapidly rising old age dependency ratios. Of course, we too need to keep an eye on those issues, but we're in a better position than most other advanced economies. This in part reflects policy decisions, including the level and composition of immigration and changes to retirement incomes policy. And I'd like to take this opportunity to talk about those issues before turning to monetary policy. Over the past decade, our population has been growing at an annual rate of 1.5%. I can bring up a graph here. You can see that the rate of population growth in Australia is higher than in most other economies. In most countries, the rate of population growth is less than 1%, and in quite a few countries now, the level of the population is actually declining. This is an important difference, with Australia's faster population growth being one of the reasons that our economies experienced faster average growth than other advanced economies over recent times. As you can see in this next chart, the increase in Australia's population growth over the past decade is largely due to increased immigration. That's the top block in this chart. You see the rate of natural increase really hasn't changed very much. Over recent times, net overseas migration has added on average about 1% to the rate of population growth, and the increase from natural sources has been around 0.7% a year. As you can see, there's been a reasonable amount of year-to-year variation in the level of migration. Migration increased sharply at the height of the resources boom, when the demand for skilled labour was very, very strong, and then it subsequently declined as the mining investment boom came to an end. In this way, migration has helped our economy adjust to the very large swings in the demand for labour, and it's also helped address some of the particular skill shortages in our economy. A second factor that accounts for the step-up in the level of migration and the year-to-year variation is a marked increase in the number of overseas students studying in Australia and changes in the policy around student visas. There are currently more than 500,000 overseas students studying in Australia. And over recent times, it's been common for around 1/6 of these foreign students to stay and live and work in Australia after completing their studies. And this has added materially to the rate of our population growth. It's also boosted our nation's human capital. People living in Australia who are born overseas are more likely than the average Australian to have a post-secondary school qualification, as you can see here. And we also benefit from stronger overseas connections when foreign students return home after studying in Australia. The effects of the faster population growth on our economy and society are complex, and understandably, they're widely debated. As a number of commentators have noted, population growth has put pressure on our infrastructure. As a country, we were slow to increase investment in infrastructure to meet the needs of the more rapidly growing population. Investment in this area has now picked up, particularly in the area of transport, and in time this will help alleviate some of the pressures that have built up over recent times. We were also slow to increase the rate of home building in response to faster population growth. As you can see in this chart, it really took the better part of a decade before the adjustment in the rate of home construction took place. I think this slow adjustment is one of the factors that has contributed to large increases in housing prices in some of our cities over recent times, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. The adjustment, though, has now taken place, and as you can see, growth in the number of dwellings has been exceeding growth in the population for a number of years now, and I think that's a positive development. I've spoken about these adjustments on previous occasions. Rather than go over that material again, I'd like to focus on something that receives less attention, but it's no less important, and that is how changes in the population dynamics have affected some of Australia's key demographic indicators. Of particular importance is the fact that on average, new migrants to Australia are considerably younger than the resident population. Workers coming to Australia tend to be relatively young, and so obviously to students. The median age of new migrants is somewhere between 20 and 25, and that's 10 years younger than the median age of the rest of us. And over the past 5 years, over 80% of net overseas migration has been accounted for by people under the age of 35. And you can see the changes in the distribution in this chart. This inflow of younger people through migration has significantly reduced the rate of population ageing in Australia. The median age in Australia is currently 37. You can see that here. Back in 2002, Australia was expected to age quite quickly, with the median age projected to increase significantly to around 45 by 2040. That's the top line in this chart. But after a decade of increased migration of younger people, the latest estimate is that the median age in 2040 will now be only around 40 years. This is a very big change in a relatively short period of time. It does remind us that our demographic trends are not set in stone and are influenced by policy. It's useful to put this change in an international perspective. To do this, the RBA staff has examined demographic trends and projections over the next quarter of a century for around 37 advanced economies using data provided by the United Nations. And the next graph shows the results of this. You can see Australia stands out in a number of dimensions. First, our median age of 37 makes us one of the youngest countries amongst the advanced economies. We're also ageing more slowly than most other countries, which means that we're projected to stay relatively young for quite a time. And this is different from the earlier projections, which were expected to move to the middle of the pack. Second, we still have higher fertility rates than most other advanced economies. Australians still tend to have larger families than those in most other advanced economies. Perhaps that's because we're more optimistic about the future, I'm not sure. Third, our average life expectancy is at the higher end of the range, and it's expected to continue to rise and basically be at a very high level. Fourth, the old age dependency ratio is rising, but it's rising less quickly than most other countries. Our relative youth and our high fertility rates mean that the dependency ratio is expected to remain lower than elsewhere over the next generation. Beyond that, on current projections, it's expected to increase quite quickly. So in summary, we're better placed than many other countries. The movement to Australia of large numbers of young people over the past decade has changed our demographic profile in a positive way. This has implications for future economic growth and for the pressures on government budgets. And importantly, the immigration has also boosted Australia's human capital. I'd now like to turn to some of the implications for labour force participation of our changing demographics. While we remain a relatively young country, we're still ageing. As is evident here, even with the large increase in relatively young migrants, the share of the Australian population aged between 15 and 64 is declining after it had increased for a number of years. This decline is projected to continue for at least a generation, reflecting a combination of ongoing transition of baby boomers into retirement ages, lower fertility rates, and increased life expectancy. By 2040, around 20% of the population is expected to be over 65, compared with 15% at the moment. All else equal, as the population ages, the proportion of people who are working could be expected to decline. But all else has not been equal. In Australia, we are seeing shifts in behaviour that have to date more than offset the effects of ageing on labour supply. In particular, the participation rates for men and women aged over 55 have increased significantly over the past two decades. You can see that in the two right-hand panels of this chart. The increase in the number of older Australians and the rise in the labour force participation means that nearly one in five employees are aged over 55. And this compares with less than 10% in the 1980s and 1990s, and you can see that shift here. There are a range of factors that are contributing to higher labour force participation by older Australians. One is the improvement in health outcomes for older people. One way of measuring this improvement is through the responses to an ABS survey in which individuals are asked to assess whether they have a health impairment that restricts their everyday activities. It's a subjective test. And the results are summarised here. As you can see, over the past decade and a half, there has been a significant decline in the share of people over 55 reporting that they have an impairment. And this improvement in health is allowing people to stay in the workforce longer. Greater acceptance of flexible work practices is also supporting this change. A related development is the ongoing shift in economic activity towards the services sector, which jobs in the services sector tend to be less physically demanding on the body. On average, labourers have one of the youngest retirement ages, as you can see, and managers and professionals have one of the oldest retirement ages. I don't know whether that's good news or bad news. You can see these differences here. But as the type of work that we do changes, it seems that more of us are in a position to spend more years working. Another factor that has encouraged increased participation by older workers are changes to retirement incomes policies. In another ABS survey, the most common reason cited by retirees for their decision to retire is eligibility for superannuation and the age pension. And the importance of this reason has increased over time, perhaps because other factors such as health have declined in importance. It seems reasonable to suggest, then, that the increase in the pension eligibility ages, particularly for women, and the increase in the preservation age for those with superannuation are both likely to have boosted labour force participation. A third set of factors are related to other financial considerations. For some people, increased life expectancy could be expected to lead to delayed retirement because of the need to work for longer to increase your savings to finance your longer life. And a loss of wealth during the global financial crisis probably had the same effect. Another financial consideration influencing retirement decisions is the tendency for people to carry debt later in life. And this tendency is shown in this next chart. The causation here runs both ways. An expectation that one will work for longer makes it possible to carry debt for longer. But for other people, the tendency to buy homes later in life and the fact that the real value of their debt erodes more slowly than it used to is likely to see them stay in the workforce longer, perhaps longer than they had planned. And finally, the increased participation rate of older women is also an extension of the ongoing increase in labour force participation across nearly all age groups for women. And this shift is in this next chart. It's been encouraged by policy changes related to parental leave and childcare and increased prevalence of flexible and part-time work. Changing societal attitudes and increased time spent in education have also played a role here. And as a result, the labour force participation rates for younger women no longer display such a pronounced dip as they progress through the childbearing years, because fewer leave the labour force entirely when they have children, although it's clear that their hours still tend to dip. So together, better health outcomes, changes in the nature of the work that we do, and changes in retirement incomes policies, and the general trend in our society towards greater female participation in the labour market are all boosting the participation rate for older Australians. The overall picture here is one of constructive adjustment to our changing demographics. I think this is another illustration of the flexibility that our economy has shown for many years. As our population continues to age, further adjustment is going to be needed. But as I spoke about earlier, Australia is better placed to deal with population ageing than most other advanced economies. I'd now like to shorten my gaze a little and turn to the near-term outlook for the Australian economy and the implications for monetary policy. The RBA will be releasing its latest forecast for the economy on Friday in the Statement of Monetary Policy. But to summarise, the outlook for GDP growth is little changed from that we've had for some time. Our central scenario remains for growth in the Australian economy to average a bit above 3% in this year and next, and the latest data have been consistent with this forecast. We also still expect the unemployment rate to move lower over time and to reach 5% at some point over the next few years. An unemployment rate of 5% is the conventional estimate of full employment for Australia, but it is possible and my hope that we could go lower than this on a sustained basis, and only time will tell. In terms of inflation, the latest data were in line with our expectations. Over the year to June, headline inflation was 2.1%. In underlying terms, it was close to 2%. And both measures are higher than the average of recent years. Over the forecast period, we expect inflation to increase further and be close to 2.5% in 2020. In the short term, though, we would not be surprised if headline inflation dipped a little, reflecting declines in some administrative prices in the September quarter. Electricity prices in some cities have declined recently after earlier very large increases, and changes in government policy are likely to result in a decline in childcare prices as measured in the CPI. And there have also been changes in some other government programs that are expected to lead to lower measured prices for some services. And together, these changes mean that our forecast for headline inflation for this year is now 1.75%, which is lower than the previous forecast. But looking beyond these short-run dynamics, inflation is still expected to rise as the economy moves closer to full employment. The labour market is gradually tightening, and it is reasonable to expect that this will lead to a shift in both wages growth and inflation. The tightening in the labour market is clearly evident in the steady increase in the number of job vacancies, with the number of vacancies as a share of the labour force at the highest level in many, many years. There's also been a significant pickup in hiring intentions by firms, and an increasing number of firms are reporting to us that they're finding it difficult to find workers with the necessary skills. As expected, the tighter labour market is leading to higher wage outcomes in certain pockets of the labour market. Over time, we expect that this will become a more general story, although I do think it's going to take some time for that to be the case. In terms of the financial risks facing the economy, things have also been broadly moving in the right direction. For a number of years, the risks were rising due to the nexus of high and rising levels of debt and escalating housing prices. Over the past year, though, housing price declines in the larger cities have reversed a small share of the earlier gains. Borrowing by investors has also slowed considerably, largely because of reduced demand by investors, and there's also been some tightening in credit standards. While banks are competing strongly for customers with low credit risk, their appetite to lend to riskier borrowers seems to have lessened a bit. And some of the non-bank lenders are now providing customers to these more risky borrowers. This change in financial trends has helped reduce the build-up of risks in our economy. It's helpful that this change is taking place at a time when the world economy is growing strongly, the unemployment rate is trending lower, and the economy is recording good growth. These developments are assisting with the adjustment in the housing market and mean that notwithstanding these changes in housing price dynamics, we still expect consumption growth of around 3% over the next couple of years. We do, though, of course, need to keep a close eye on developments in this area. So in summary, we see reasonable prospects that the economy will record good growth, the unemployment rate will come down gradually, and that inflation will increase over time. Well, this is a favourable outlook. We shouldn't lose sight of that. If this is how things evolve, you could expect the next move in interest rates to be up and not down. As the economy strengthens and income growth and inflation lift, it would be natural for interest rates to return to more normal levels over time. The timing of any future change in interest rates is dependent upon the speed of the progress that's made in reducing the unemployment rate and having inflation return to around the midpoint of the target range on a sustained basis. If we were to make faster progress than we currently expect, any future increase in interest rates is likely to be earlier. Conversely, slower progress would likely see a longer period without an adjustment. But for the time being, though, the Reserve Bank Board's judgment remains that the best course for us is to maintain the cash rate at its current level. Given that the progress in reducing unemployment and having inflation return to the midpoint of the target range is expected to be only gradual, the board does not see a strong case for a near-term adjustment in monetary policy. Instead, the board is seeking to be a source of confidence and stability to support the progress that the Australian economy is continuing to make. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you, Phil, for such a topical and timely speech. As Phil said, he's been very generous and agreed to answer some questions. So we have some microphones on either side of the room here. When you come up and ask your question, please state your name and affiliation and try to keep your questions to the point. And if you have to make a statement, please make them keep it very short. Thank you.
You'll take the lead.
I'll take the first one. Phil, you mentioned in the statement yesterday there was just a brief mention about the trade tensions around the world. It seems that you're sort of not taking too seriously yet the tensions between China particularly and the US. How closely is the bank watching these sorts of developments, or is it something that's happening in the background that Australia's largely immune to for now?
Well, we're watching it like everybody else is. I go to a lot of international meetings, and over the weekend I was in Manila at a meeting of the Asian Central Bank governors, and the issue of trade was discussed quite a lot there. So people are still quite worried about this. But there are lots of scenarios here. So I don't think we can predict how this is going to play out. There are actually scenarios where that are positive, that we end up with some trade liberalisation out of the kind of argy-bargy that's going on, and that could support growth. But there are other scenarios where this escalates, and that will be very damaging for the global economy. One thing to watch is whether investment is declining because of uncertainty. I think you've seen Canada, that's the case, and Mexico, and if the financial markets reacted adversely as well. So, and it's a risk. There are lots of scenarios, so it's very hard to kind of to work out how this is going to play out. But it's not, it's, you know, I think the good scenarios have fairly low probability, I think.
Right.
But possible.
Governor Andrew Tarsis from Nomura. Should inflation targeting central banks wait until it looks like inflation's about to strike the midpoint of their target band before they make a first move, particularly when they're coming from something which is away away from normal.
So I didn't catch the first part of the question.
Oh, sorry. I said, should inflation targeting central banks wait for inflation to strike the midpoint of their target band before making a first move?
Well, I don't think that would be the right approach. I mean, we operate a forward-looking monetary policy. We've done that for three decades, and it's served us very effectively. So at the moment, our projection of inflation is that things remain low and below the midpoint. So that's why we're keeping interest rates steady. If we had a forecast of inflation going above 2.5%, then at some point we would be raising rates. And I don't think it'd be the right thing to do to wait till you got there necessarily.
Rory Robertson, Westpac Group Treasury. Governor Lowe, thanks for your talk and congratulations on your 2 years of masterly inaction that Mike Baird referred to. So there's a bit of a debate out in the financial community about how the Reserve Bank thinks about house prices. You've said very clearly today that the bank's best guess is that unemployment is edging lower towards 5%, inflation's edging higher towards 2.5% midpoint, perhaps by the end of the forecast horizon, and you know the next move in rates is up. Maybe later, maybe sooner, we'll see. There's a view in the financial community that the Reserve Bank can't and won't raise rates if house prices are falling. And one of your board members made a bit of a splash a couple of months ago by saying the bank will raise interest rates because inflation is starting to pick up, when wages and inflation are starting to pick up. When all that starts to line up, who cares what's happening to house prices. Right now they're falling. I wonder if you could talk about how the bank balances its inflation outlook and the potential need to raise rates against the need for the financial community to see rising house prices.
Yeah. Well, as I said to Andrew's question, the framework that we use to make our decisions is really about the outlook for inflation and the outlook for the unemployment rate. The housing market feeds into those two things. So that's how we think about the housing market. It's not a goal. Housing prices are not a goal of ours, and we don't target them. But we do try and understand the effects of housing price changes on household consumption. At some point, housing prices here had to stop rising much more quickly than our incomes. We've been doing that for a number of years, and there's a lot of borrowing associated with that, and I was quite worried about where that would end up. So, to address that, I think we do need a period of moderate house price increases or some declines are not particularly problematic. And if we're going to have a period of adjustment in the housing market, what type of environment do you want to have it in? As I said in my remarks, I want to have it in an environment where the global economy is growing strongly, the Australian economy is doing quite well, interest rates are low. So I think we'll get through this adjustment, and in the end it's healthy. That the prices aren't continuing to rise and the credit dynamics have changed as well, and it increases the chance that we can sustain growth for kind of more years to come.
Thank you.
Thanks, Justin Faber, Macquarie. We've got inflation going to the midpoint of the band over the next couple of years now in the forecasts. But when we look at other kind of advanced economies, they struggle to get to their targets, the midpoint of their target. Unemployment rates well below Nehru's. What's different here, and what gives you kind of confidence that is going to be different here, given your unemployment rate forecasts? Now, I get the sense from your recent comments about low inflation's kind of here to stay when you're overseas, that do you feel like the risks are skewed to not actually getting there to that 2.5%?
I really don't think what's happening here is that different to what's happening overseas. In the US and in parts of the euro area, inflation is rising, kind of slowly, but it's rising, and the rise is very gradual. And what's happening here, inflation is rising, the inflation rate now is higher than the average of recent years, and the pickup is really gradual, and it's a global thing. As I said in my remarks when I was at the ECB conference, I think it's coming down largely to increased competition. Increased competition in the labour market and increased competition in the goods market, partly from globalisation, but other factors as well. And when people feel like there's more competition, you don't put your price up as much. So globalisation, changes in technology, have kind of made people feel like there's more competition. And so the system is less inflation prone, but I'm still confident in the basic relationships. That if the labour market in Australia becomes sufficiently tight, wage growth will pick up. And one reason I'm confident about that is I talk to a number of businesses and they tell me in their segments where things are very tough, they're having to pay quite large wage increases now that the laws of supply and demand still work, don't they?
Andrew Stone, just private consultant. I wanted to go to your remarks about immigration, Governor, if I could, and actually take issue with your comments, your generally positive comments about the younging effect of immigration on the ageing of the population. I noticed the charts you showed typically showed data through to the projections through to the early 2040s, so roughly over a 25-year time period. But my understanding is that the basic demographic models have actually been quite clear on this issue for quite a while, that undoubtedly, because immigrants tend to be much younger than the domestic population, they do produce a short-term younging of the population, but that effect fades very quickly, so that if you look on a 50 to 100-year timetable, you actually get very little positive effect on younging of the population, precisely because those immigrants then age. In fact, as long as 20 years ago, in a paper of the Department of Immigration, noted demographer Peter MacDonald put it this way, he said, "Those who wish to argue for a higher level of immigration must base their argument on the benefits of a larger population, not upon the illusory younging power of high immigration." And I might add, even the basic demographic modelling that he'd done did not take into account the fact that if you have a big increase in migration, as we've had, effectively a doubling of the net overseas migration rate, that, as you noted, has a big effect on house prices, which in turn may actually have a depressing effect on the fertility rate, because after all, there are lots of people now thinking, can we start a family now with house prices so high, or can we afford to have two children instead of one, or three children instead of two? So I was wondering, have you looked at those demographic projections on a 50 to 100-year horizon, and more generally, are you actually confident, in fact, of this claim that on a long horizon you will get a younging effect from high immigration?
I have looked at what happens beyond 2040, and Australia will, on current projections, will age quite quickly after 2040, because the current group of young people who are coming here will, by 2040, start to be getting kind of into middle age and later. So we will have an issue beyond 2040, and a lot of other policy variables can change between now and then. And I acknowledge these other effects of immigration you were talking about, and I was really just trying to lay out what I saw as kind of some of the key economic benefits, but there are other issues as well, and I think it's useful to have a long-term horizon, as you say.
Can I just urge everyone to keep their comments very brief? We've got quite a lot of questions to be answered. So, Michael.
Governor, Michael Blythe for Commonwealth Bank. We know the Reserve Bank runs a very big liaison program, and we get the occasional sort of tantalising glimpse of what's in that program, including from what you've had to say today. Is it about time the Reserve Bank followed the Fed and started publishing its own beige book or equivalent?
Well, I think the Federal Reserve talks to a lot more businesses with all its kind of, it's a much bigger country, obviously, so they're able to aggregate information more effectively than we do. The approach that we've taken is really to try and get the gems from our liaison program and to put those in our documents. You know, to try and to pick out the things that are probably going to be most useful for you rather than kind of giving you yet more documents to read. Other people could make a different judgment whether that's the right approach, but we want to highlight the gems for you.
Good afternoon, Governor Lowe. My name is Ryan Williams, and I'm in Year 12 at Guymon Technology High School, studying economics. Australia is the only country with AAA credit rating of the 11 countries that sustains such a large foreign debt, which currently exceeds $1 trillion, according to the Australian. With growing concerns regarding our credit rating, what actions are the RBA taking in order to diminish the large foreign debt to maintain Australia's AAA credit rating?
Well, the Reserve Bank really doesn't have that as an objective.
Yeah.
My objective is delivering 2.5% inflation, having unemployment rate as low as it possibly can be, and making sure the financial system is secure and stable. So they're my objectives.
Yeah.
It's really up to the politicians in Canberra.
Yeah, but do you think that?
And the current trajectory of government debt, I think, is a positive one. I mean, debt levels rose quite a lot, and it's important that we keep getting those down so that that we have fiscal space next time when there's a downturn. And, but it's I haven't got any instruments for that. It's my colleagues in Canberra.
Thank you.
Sophia Rodriguez from MNI. In your speech, you say that for the if this is how things evolve, the next move in the cash rate is likely to be up. And then you go on to talk about the speed of the progress made. So in case it's faster, then you will hike rates earlier. And then what happens if this is not how things evolve? Will you consider cut?
Well, if that isn't how things evolve, then they'll have a different policy path, obviously. If there was some terrible global shock and the global economy weakened and Australia kind of had the side effects of that, we still have scope to adjust policy, both on interest rates, and we've thought about other policies that we could implement as well. So that's not the central scenario, but it's possible, and we've thought about what we would do in that case. The most likely scenario is the economy continues on its current track. Good growth, trending lower unemployment, and gently rising inflation. And in that world, I hope that at some point during my term, Mike, that I'll be able to raise interest rates, not because I want to raise them, but because it would be a sign that income growth had picked up, that inflation had turned into target, and that the unemployment rate was kind of very low. So I'm hoping at some point, and it would be better if it were sooner rather than later, because it would be better that kind of we hit full employment and wage and income growth picked up. But we'll have to wait and see.
Hi, Governor. Patrick Cummins from the Australian Financial Review. I just had a question a little bit about that, on that theme. The inflation has had trouble getting back towards the target, not just here, all around the world. And at the same time, you know, we've had historically low rates now for a couple of years. Meanwhile, household debt's very high. We've got very high house price affordability problem. At what point, or do you think it's... do you think it's possible that the RBA may consider its inflation target, perhaps lowering it towards 2%, like they do in, you know, like the Americans or the Europeans? I note the Norwegians did it earlier this year. I'm not sure, is there scope for lowering that just so the economic cycle, which seems quite strong, doesn't pull apart from the financial cycle so strongly?
Yeah. Not anytime soon. I'm not looking to kind of review the inflation target any time. Most kind of the academic work says that if you were to review the inflation target, you should have a higher target rather than a lower one. And the benefit of a higher target, according to the academics, is that you would have a higher average level of interest rates. And because you would have a higher average level of interest rates, you would have more scope to reduce interest rates in a downturn. So you could deliver more stimulus. So certainly in the academic and most of the policy community, very few people argue that inflation targets should be lower because that would give less flexibility in a downturn. I think that's a reasonable argument. Another argument that I think has merit is that we've had this arrangement, you know, for a long period of time now. It has a lot of credibility. People understand the inflation rate's going to be kind of 2 point something rather in Australia. And there's a lot of benefit that we get from anchoring inflation expectations in that way. If we decided we wanted to change that, then maybe we'd decide we want to change it again at some future point. And I think you would lose the benefit of kind of really anchored inflation expectations. So, of course, we keep looking at these things all the time, but I don't have any appetite at the moment to borrow, because I think we will get back to 2.5%. I'm confident we will, and it's just going to take time, and we have to be patient. And while we're making progress, the board's view is that we just sit still, be a source of confidence and stability so that people don't have to worry about interest rates every month. We can go on with kind of building businesses and creating jobs.
Lucas Baird, Australian Banking and Finance, no relation to Mike. The shadow board think tank out of ANU have been fielding arguments that rates should rise over the last few months, including one suggestion that the longer rates remain well below any reasonable definition of a neutral rate, the greater the imbalances and potential pain later on. What do you make of those suggestions and similar?
Well, obviously, I don't kind of agree with them, because if I'd be a bit of adjusted rates. So I think there have been a few arguments that I've seen recently kind of why we should have higher rates, and none of them I've found convincing. One is that it would protect against the depreciation of the currencies, the yields, spreads widen. You know, between the US and Australia, the dollar I could depreciate, and then we'd have too much inflation. So that's an argument that's made. My view on that one is we should just wait and see what the currency does, because we're not very good at predicting it. Another argument has been the kind of the debt side of the economy was growing too quickly, and you were alluding to this, and the higher interest rates would kind of cause that to adjust. Well, I think the debt, the credit situation is much more sound than it has been for a long period of time, so I don't see higher interest rates as an argument to, or the need to slow credit growth as an argument for higher interest rates. Another argument that I've sometimes heard is that it would give us kind of more policy space to lower rates if we had a downturn. But of course, I mean, in a way that's true, but it would also mean that the short-term outlook would be weaker. So I don't find that particularly convincing. And another argument that I've read is that the low interest rates are helping the economy grow quite well, and that's allowing the government to kind of be less diligent in pursuing reform than otherwise might be. So if we had higher rates, slower growth, the government might do more. I don't find that argument convincing either, and it's not my job to kind of put pressure directly or indirectly on the government to do that. So we certainly thought about the arguments that I've read in the press. We debate them internally, but as I've kind of quickly run through here, at least at the moment, I don't find any of them compelling.
Thank you.
Governor Phil Lasker from the ABC. In your speech, you mentioned that the conventional measure for full employment is 5% unemployment, but we could go lower than that on a sustained basis. I'm thinking unwanted wage pressures if we go below 5%. What would an economy look like that had below 5% on a sustained basis? Does it suggest that we're a massive increase in immigration to reduce wage pressures?
No, I don't know at what point. I don't have confidence at what point wage growth is going to pick up noticeably. The conventional calculations is it's around 5%, but it could be because of structural changes in our labour market and these perceptions of competition that we could go lower. It's quite possible we could have an unemployment rate of, you know, 4.5%, somewhere between 4.5% and 5%, and that be consistent with 2.5% inflation. I certainly hope that we can go lower than 5%, but we just have to wait and see. In other countries, we've seen the unemployment rate go below conventional estimates of full employment without causing wage pressures to build up too much. And because I see the factors causing low inflation to be global, I think it's perfectly possible that the same thing happens here.
Without it having an army of working poor, so to speak?
One way of getting kind of a lower equilibrium unemployment rate is to have a lower level of wages. Lower wages mean more people employed. I don't think that's the path to get a lower structural unemployment rate. It's businesses working, training workers and working on skills, and we can sit with an unemployment rate of 4 point something, I would hope. But I haven't got a kind of a dogmatic view on that. The truth is we don't really know. But
Bill Evans from Westpac, Governor. Along the lines of the previous question, but looking at it from a totally different perspective, looking at your forecasts for the unemployment rate, which at the moment is 5.25% by the middle of 2020, but we heard yesterday that maybe you're going to be lowering that, possibly because you're increasing your forecast period to the end of 2020, yeah. So you might have 5% by the end of 2020. Yeah. Obviously, I can't ask you to confirm that. You're accepting that the Nauru is probably lower, given all the evidence that we've seen around the world. And so I would look at your unemployment forecasts and say there's very little confidence that you expect any real movement in wages if the unemployment rate is sticking comfortably above the Nauru for the whole of the forecast period. And if that's the case, does that question your ability to achieve the inflation target, to get the consumption levels that you're expecting? So can you share with us some views as to why those unemployment forecasts are going to be consistent with upward pressure on wages?
Yep. On the unemployment rate forecast, we are extending it out to the end of 2020, and that is the reason why the forecast unemployment rate is now going to have is 5 rather than 5.25%. You said that I accepted the proposition that Naira is lower. I don't accept that proposition. I'm open to the possibility that that is the case, and I certainly hope that's the case. I don't think about wage growth and inflation in quite the same mechanistic sense that you were suggesting, the kind of this kind of small gaps between the Naira and the unemployment rate kind of drive inflation. As a general proposition, that idea is true, but I don't think about it so mechanically. What I do see at the moment, talking to businesses, is wage growth is picking up where there's a tension between supply and demand. And I think there will be more tension between supply and demand over the next couple of years. And therefore, I think wage growth is going to pick up. I don't think it's going to pick up massively, and I think it can pick, if it picks up slowly, then perhaps we can have some pick up in wage growth. When we haven't got to the Naira, we can gradually, by having reasonable employment growth, kind of quarter after quarter, get the Naira down. We're open to that possibility.
Governor Michael Heath from Bloomberg News. Just wondering, you mentioned the offshore shock a little while ago. I mean, you know, if there was one, what's the greater risk for Australia? Is it the debt in China's financial system, or is it the possibility of a trade war? And I say the latter in the context of the rhetoric really seems to be hardening now. You've had the Chinese saying the US is trying to make it a vassal state, but they'll never give in. You've had the US saying China runs purely protectionist policy, its economy is weaker than it lets on. I mean, it really is starting to get quite strident, and I'm just wondering, for us, where are we looking? You know, is it inside China, or is it trade? Where are you focusing at least?
Well, they're both significant issues, and I wouldn't know how to balance those, so which one was more important than the other. They're both significant, and I think the Chinese seem to be taking very, very seriously the need to address the risks in the financial system. And just recently, in China, we've seen easing across a number of measures. The monetary policy has been eased a bit. Obviously, the exchange rate against the US dollar is down nearly 10% over recent times. And there's been some small easing in fiscal policy as well. So the Chinese authorities are responding to some slowdown, thereby responding. And as far as I can tell, they're doing it in a way that's not adding to risks in the financial system, mm-hmm. which is the big challenge, to keep growth going without adding to risks in the financial system and containing those. And on the trade front, I've got nothing to say other than what I said before. There are a range of scenarios. Some are quite positive. Some are very negative. You have to wait, put probability attachments to each of them.
Okay, thanks.
That is the last two questions. We'll go this side.
Sarah Hunter from BIS Oxford Economics. Thank you for your speech, Governor. I think you've made it pretty clear that the cash rate's unlikely to be going up anytime soon. But we have seen short-term funding costs go up for the banks in recent months, with monetary tightening, particularly in the US, sort of feeding through. And this has, for some of the smaller lenders, resulted in them putting up the mortgage rates as well, albeit by very small amounts. How concerned are you by further tightening, particularly by the Fed, and that feeding through to our borrowing costs here, and that then getting into mortgage rates and other lending costs, and that being a drag on growth, despite the fact that you may not have moved the cash rate from where we are now?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of focus on the fact at the moment on the fact that a number of banks have increased their standard variable rate. We at the Reserve Bank, through our database on loans that have been securitized, can track the average interest rate that Australians are paying on mortgages. And it's lower than it was late last year, and it's been trending down. So there's been some high-profile adjustments, but the average interest rate that people are paying is 20 or 30 basis points lower than it was last year. And one reason for that is there's quite a lot of competition at the moment for high-quality borrowers. So there's clearly been some tightening of credit standard for less good-quality borrowers, but the interest rates that good quality borrowers are not rising. Whether that remains the case, it remains to be seen. But there is competition, and each kind of month when we get the data, the average interest rate that people are paying is lower than the month before. Kind of not consistent with kind of generally the vibe that you kind of get. But people are getting discounts. You kind of, and I say this to everyone. If you're unhappy with your interest rate you're getting, go to your bank manager and ask for a lower one. Because when I tell people this, they sometimes come back and they say, yep, it actually worked. And because the banks want to make loans, if you could quality borrow there, you can get a good deal. So at the moment, I'm not particularly concerned about rising mortgage rates.
Phil, Carol Austin. There's been a great deal of debate about the importance of being internationally competitive in tax rates. And in this area, the US is clearly leading the world down in tax rates. There's been much less discussion about being internationally competitive in the expenditure side of balance sheets. And if we look at the US and think of that as potentially the role model, we've seen longevity peak and actually decline. American men are dying younger today than they did 5 years ago. We're seeing very soft participation rates in the United States. Is there a role for the Reserve Bank to think about how social policy influences important economic variables like longevity, participation rate, and other outcomes of social policies?
Well, we try and take into account every possible variable we can, and as I illustrated, I hope, in my talk today, we look kind of the retirement age of different occupations, the kind of the why people say they're retiring, how healthy people are, and we try and understand what are the implications of that for the broader economy. And as I talked about here, the fact that we're healthier, I mean, more of us are working later in life, and that's helping jobs growth and economic dynamism. And so we look at those things. It's not our kind of core objective to kind of understand how various social trends influence output and inflation, but we certainly kind of understand what we're doing has to be seen in a very broad context, and that was partly what I was doing today.
Thank you. Thank you. Governor, thanks very much. Please thank the Governor again.